from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Human beings have not always been the top predator in the food chain. We evolved with the vivid understanding that somewhere out there, maybe nearby, great and terrible creatures were hunting, and we were as good a meal as any. The planet's mightiest predators, lions, tigers, bears, and more, crept into our villages, our mythology, our imaginations. Author David Quammen warns that when the great beasts are gone, humans may never be the same. Tonight on Point, the last of the great predators and the meaning of the dwindling numbers for the planet's life and the human mind. But first, the latest from Capitol Hill on the empty-handed hunt for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. In statements released after a day of closed-door testimony, David Kaye, the top U.S. official in the search, reported on the progress of the Iraq Survey Group. I asked Walter Pincus, national security correspondent for The Washington Post, to describe the heart of Kaye's message to Congress.
Well, I think the basic message, which is apparently surprised not just Democrats but Republicans and got them very uneasy, is that not only have they not found any chemical or biological weapons, but when it came to the nuclear program, which initially was the fearsome part of all this, that he could gain a nuclear weapon and we wouldn't find out there's a mushroom cloud, at best he had to say it's a very tentative restart, if a restart at all, to the nuclear program. And even Dr. Kaye said that it does not look like a massive reconstituted program, which was the thrust, even of the controversial thrust, to the National Intelligence Estimate of last October.
So after all the waiting for David Kaye's first report here, it appears to be a further refutation of the pre-war intelligence that justified the war?
It raises extremely serious questions, although Kaye himself says, and everybody has to stop for a minute, he needs 6 to 9 months more. There's another reemphasis of they were working for years to hide the programs. But I think he's pretty well ruled out that there were weapons, and he doesn't seem to have found any indication that they were recently destroyed just before the war, which was another story that was floating around.
Walter Pincus, President Bush has asked for more money to put into the search for weapons of mass destruction. Can you describe the operation that David Kaye is currently leading there? How much more money is Washington looking for, and what would that mean in terms of the search effort?
Well, he's got 1,200 people working with him, a mixture of military people, scientists, and a core group of former UN inspectors, including two British scientists who were former leaders. Kaye was a specialist in nuclear, and the two British scientists are from the chemical and biological field, so that they've got a very good group. The amount of money they're seeking, which the New York Times reported today, was $600 million, and it's classified for some reason, could include money to begin paying people to try to get them to say things, because he points out, and it's been an issue before, that a lot of scientists don't want to talk about this.
Did Kaye say today that he needs more resources? 1,200 people sounds like a pretty good-sized staff.
His argument, of course, is this is a country the size of California, that there is examples of how much material has been buried, how hidden the program was, and that when you get to chemical and biological weapons, you can hide serious activities inside somebody's garage, so that the amount of area they have to cover is just enormous. But I think the basic underlying thing is that he keeps talking about 3 months, but you also remember 2 months prior to that, there was a military effort going on. Mm-hmm. So 5 months has really not found very much.
Was there any evidence that he came up with to support the thesis that there had been active WMD programs or planning in the 1990s, in the run-up to war?
He talks actually in one part about Saddam Hussein talking about how long it would take to get some chemical weapons and getting answers in the month period, and how his son asking a question of somebody. But these are all anecdotal, and there is a lot of discussion of how much was destroyed, how much had vanished, organized destruction, organized looting, a lot of indications that there was an active program to hide things as the war began and after the war ended.
You said that even Republicans were taken aback at how little he came forward with, in fact, even saying not much evidence on the nuclear front. What did you hear after his closed-door testimony before the House and Senate Intelligence Committees today? Were congressmen talking?
Several congressmen had made statements. A colleague has just called me because we're putting a story together, and she is saying that even Senator Lott was surprised at how little has been turned up. Senator Rockefeller came out after the session and said there were no surprises, and he doesn't believe there are impending surprises, and that he says we've got to start looking at how the intelligence that got us into war went so wrong.
Walter Pincus, where do you think this is all headed? David Kay will now go back and look some more. The White House has an issue it has to manage. Do you expect a continuing focus on trying to find evidence of these weapons programs, or an effort to sort of quiet the whole issue down and nudge it aside?
I don't think the issue can be nudged aside. I think there's too much on both sides of the aisle to question, to allow that to happen. It does raise serious questions about how the intelligence interpreted the material they had, and also re-raises the question that's been raised before as to what the administration policymakers did with the intelligence they had to turn it into the kind of threat that they felt justified going to war against Saddam Hussein.
Walter Pincus, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Walter Pincus covers national security for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. For tens of thousands of years, man-eating predators have haunted the edges of human habitat, spirituality, and imagination. Out beyond the fire's light or the safety of huts and houses lurked great beasts that made us feel vulnerable, that taught us the meaning of courage and humility, and the frailty of our own existence, creatures that made us afraid. From the biblical Leviathan to Blake's tiger to the imagined monsters of science fiction, humans have paid homage to the beast. Now, the big cats, the giant bears, and the fiercest crocodiles have been driven to remote corners of the world. They may not be long for this world. And if they vanish, what is lost to the world and humans they leave behind? Tonight, we look at monsters of God and their deep place in the human psyche. Have you been face to face with an alpha predator? If you live far from the habitat of great beasts, do lions and tigers and bears still play a part in your imagination? Do humans need the threat of fang and claw to sustain a thread of species humility? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota is David Quammen, author of Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. Good evening and welcome, David Quammen.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. What a big look you've taken at where these great beasts stand today, where they've stood for an awfully long time in the human psyche, and what it might mean if because of their diminishing numbers, humans and these great predators part ways. I wonder if you'd just jump right in with a little reading for us, David Quammen, right from the top of the book.
Sure.
And give us a sense of the perspective that you're bringing to this big investigation.
Okay, this is the first paragraph of the book. Great and terrible flesh-eating beasts have always shared landscape with humans. They were part of the ecological matrix within which Homo sapiens evolved. They were part of the psychological context in which our sense of identity as a species arose. They were part of the spiritual systems that we invented for coping. The teeth of big predators, their claws, their ferocity and their hunger were grim realities that could be eluded but not forgotten. Every once in a while, a monstrous carnivore emerged like doom from a forest or a river to kill someone and feed on the body. It was a familiar sort of disaster, like auto fatalities today, that must have seemed freshly, shockingly gruesome each time, despite the familiarity. And it conveyed a certain message. Among the earliest forms of human self-awareness was the awareness of being meat.
David Quammen reading from his new book, Monster of God. It's all about
big beasts, big predators, alpha predators, he calls them. And we'll get you to define exactly what you mean by that in just a moment, David Coleman. But you go on to write that these aren't just zoo animals or figures in storybooks, though the story aspect of these animals is very important. But you say that the great beasts, the great predators, have a crucial or have had a crucial and irreplaceable regulatory role within the human mind. What do you mean by that?
Well, among other things, I mean that they have reminded us that we're part of a food chain, that, as I say in that opening passage, we're just another flavor of meat. And in doing that, they've reminded us that we're part of nature. We're part of the natural world. We're not separate from it. We're not above it. We're not aloof from the natural world. We are part of nature. And I think that that has been a very, very important, just incredibly important to us in defining our role in the world.
And at the crux of your book is the idea that this relationship, which has gone on for 35,000 years, may be, in your terms, within a century and a half of ending. What exactly are you suggesting? What's going extinct? What may be lost?
Well, let me bounce backward just a second first time and say this has gone on. We have art that documents this relationship that's as old as 35,000 years, cave paintings in France. But this relationship between these predators and us goes back more than a million years to as long as humans have been recognizably human.
And don't worry, we won't leap past that. We're going to go back and look at it, but I just want to get a sense of the junction that you describe as looming now.
Right. Well, now as we humans have multiplied to the point where there are 6.3 billion of us on this planet, we have claimed landscape all over the globe with our cities, our suburban sprawl, our agriculture, our use of resources. We've transformed landscape to the point where these big predators now only exist generally in small, isolated, relatively beleaguered populations. Now, some of them are in much better shape than others, but generally, they are endangered species. Many of them, and many of them on the brink of endangerment.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Well, if we continue along the way we're going now, with human population growth expected to, according to the UN Population Division, it may well peak at 11 billion humans in 150 years. If we do that, then I just can't imagine that there will be room, there will be wild landscape, there will be habitat for these creatures, really any of them, to survive as viable populations in the wild.
The creatures that you're most focused on, you call alpha predators. How do you define that category and what animals do you put in it?
Right. It's a label I've invented. It's not an ecological category. It's not a scientific category. It's a psychological category that I've created to indicate those species of big predator that are large enough, fierce enough, indiscriminate, and solitary enough such that a single individual of one of those species can and occasionally does kill and eat a human.
And the particular species that you look at in the book?
Well, it's a short, formidable list of alpha predators. It includes lions, tigers, leopard, brown bear, polar bear, a couple of species of crocodile, the saltwater crocodile in Australia and southeastern Asia, the Nile crocodile in Africa, a couple of species of shark, including the great white shark, a couple of species of giant snake, including the anaconda, also the jaguar in Latin America, and probably the cougar in Western North America. And that is just about it. That is the list of alpha predators.
We're going to come back and look at that. But all these thousands of years humans have spent in no small part when they ran into these animals trying to kill them, David Coleman. Now you're standing up to say, no, there's a relationship here. Despite all the danger, when you're face-to-face with one, they need to be preserved.
Well, in some cultures, in some places, we've tried to kill them. And in other cultures, as I show in the book, native peoples have venerated them, have learned to cope with them, have incorporated them into their creation myths and their theologies and belief structures.
Or venerated and hunted at the same time. David Quammen, please stand by. We're talking tonight about lions, tigers, bears, the vanishing alpha predators, and the impact of their loss on the planet and human psyche. Do you buy the thesis that the very existence of great predators has historically kept humans humble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about lions, tigers, bears, the vanishing alpha predators, and the impact of their loss on the planet and on human psyche. My guest tonight is David Quammen. He's author of the new book, Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. You can join this conversation as well. If you live far from the habitat of great beasts, do lions, tigers, and bears still play a part in your imagination, in your understanding of the world? In an age of Ebola, anthrax, and terrorism, do we really need animal predators to keep us scared and humble? And what do we lose if we lose the last magnificently scary beasts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Quammen, you described so richly this long, long relationship between man and beast here. Walk us into some of that. The early evidence of it you began to describe there, its place in literature, in mythology, in religion. Mm-hmm.
There is, for instance, Tom, a cave, a Paleolithic art cave that was discovered just about 10 years ago in southern France. And it's called Chauvet Cave. And unlike all the other famous Paleolithic art caves like Lascaux and Altamira in Europe, this one contains beautiful paintings not just of prey animals, not just of zebra and antelope and deer of various sorts, but predators also. In particular, it contains paintings, gorgeous portraits of what scientists now call the European cave lion. It was a maneless lion, larger than the African lion of today, but closely related to it, that lived across Europe during that period of time. And the people, the shamans or whoever they were, who painted those paintings inside Chauvet Cave, expressed an incredible admiration, a veneration, a respect for the beauty of these animals, not just a fear or a loathing or a resentment of these predators that could treat them as prey.
You use the phrase monster of God in your title. What's the origin of that? Why do you use it?
Right. It's a reference in particular to one of the famous monsters, carnivorous predators from literature and scripture. Namely Leviathan from the Old Testament. The book of Job in particular is where the figure of Leviathan is described by the Lord, by Yahweh, when he is reminding Job that Job should remain humble before the Lord and faithful to the Lord despite all the travails that have been visited upon him. The Lord starts talking about this creature, Leviathan. It's not a whale. That's a later interpretation of the word. But in the book of Job, it's a fire-breathing, smoky-nostriled, long-toothed, kind of a cross between a sea dragon and a saltwater crocodile. Yeah. And the Lord points to it and says to Job, "None is so bold that dare stir him up. Who then shall stand before me?" It's a reminder to Job, and by extension to all of us, that humans stand not first and not even second, but third on the food chain of power and glory.
And your point throughout the book, David Quammen, is that it is the power and the glory and the threat of these real predators that gave rise to the whole idea, the concept of the monster for the human, and that the monster, the beast, the great beast, is critical to humans understanding their place in the world.
I do. In ancient literature, ancient history, first you can find references to Assyrian kings and Egyptian pharaohs doing battle against lions, killing lions from their war chariots. And this was a measure of leadership, a measure of the macho of the great kings. And then in later literature, for instance, the Old English poem Beowulf, you find the warlord, the titled character, Beowulf himself, who does battle against a flesh-eating predator whose
Grendel.
Name is Grendel.
Yeah.
Right, right. And this, my argument is that Grendel exists partly because the people who created this poem, created the myths behind it, carried, you could almost call it a species or a racial memory of sharing the landscape with actual physical zoological monsters that could kill and eat them.
Now, today, what species that you'd qualify as alpha predators are endangered and which are not?
Well, one population, one subspecies of alpha predator that I look at in the book that's very endangered is the Asiatic lion. The lion used to live, Panthera leo, the same lion we know from Africa, mm-hmm. used to live also all across southwestern Asia, lived in Iraq and Iran, lived in the Mideast.
Not to mention France and Germany and even Britain, which I was surprised. Had you say at one point lions roamed Britain?
At one point they did, yes, but that's going back tens of thousands of years. Mm. Even within the last century, this subspecies of lion survived in, for instance, southern Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, northern India. It was exterminated all across that range with the rise of modern firearms and the transformation of its habitat for human agriculture, and survived only in the wild in one little forest reserve in western India, a place called the Gir Forest, G-I-R. Mm-hmm. Now it's a national park and a wildlife sanctuary, not a very large place. It's hilly forest, and there are roughly 325 of these Asiatic lions that survive in that forest.
And you were there, you saw them. Do they still look to you in that diminished circumstance like monsters of God? Is the chemistry still there?
It's always there. It is there, Tom, yeah. But they are in diminished circumstances. There's no doubt about that. They've gone through a near brush with extinction at the end of the 19th century. They were down to only about a dozen or two dozen individuals. They were protected then at the very last minute. The Indian government now has declared their habitat a national park and wildlife sanctuary. They have bred back up to the point where, as I said, there are more than 300 of them, although their gene pool is still incredibly small because of that genetic bottleneck that they went through when there were only a few dozen of them. So they are jeopardized in a number of ways. The habitat keeps being eroded. The population of humans keeps growing. And with as little genetic diversity as they have, they could conceivably be wiped out by one viral epidemic that might sweep through their forest.
And you look out 150 years and you say at that point, animals that need the kind of range and space that alpha predators do to roam, to find their prey, well, it's just not going to be there. And you fear that all of them could essentially be gone except for a kind of genetically degraded strains behind bars in zoos.
I do. I'm afraid that's where we're going. That's where current trends certainly are taking us. These are big, ferocious animals that need big areas of landscape to survive in viable populations. And those big areas of landscape increasingly are not available. Even the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem in the Northern Rockies, near where I live, is thought of as a great sanctuary for grizzly bears. But the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem contains only probably 400 or 500 grizzly bears at most at this point. They're completely isolated, and the habitat there continues to be eroded around the edges, and they may not survive for another 150 years.
But that experience of being face-to-face with an alpha predator or hearing the legend, the lore, the story of someone who has been there is one. It's very deeply imprinted. We're talking tonight with David Quammen, author of Monster of God. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Peter's calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Sure.
30 years ago, or 30-plus years ago, I did a movie called Blue Water White Death.
And oh, yeah.
The privilege of being face-to-face with the great white shark, the privilege and surviving it. But I very much agree with your guests. It was a tremendous experience to be just inches away from an alpha predator who regarded me as nothing more than a can of tuna fish.
Did you feel put in your place by that brush with the great white, Peter?
You know, actually, I did the night before because we were feeding the fish to keep it around for one last day of filming, and I was alone on deck in the middle of the Great Australian Bight, and I could see the fish just cruising quietly beneath our boat, and our deck was slimy with oil and fish oil and fish guts, and I realized if I just fell into the water at that moment, he just scooped me up the way he was eating the chum that I was feeding him.
You'd just be a snack. What was the size of this shark, Peter?
He was about 16 feet long, probably about 3,500 pounds. And he thoroughly, I was in a cage the next morning, and he thoroughly bent the cage up. But I did survive. But it was a beautiful, a scary at the time experience, but a beautiful one at the same time.
What's your thought of what's lost if such creatures are lost, Peter?
Oh, it's a tremendous loss. It's incalculable. For now we were on a great adventure, and now people can take tours to do the same kind of thing that we were doing then. And I think that a lot of people, Peter Benchley included, who wrote a scene from Jaws based on that episode, Peter is very much, opposed to the killing of sharks now, and has done a lot of work to help save them. But it would be an incalculable loss to have these animals gone.
Yes, clearly it would. But you had that experience, and thanks for sharing it with us, Peter. I want to take another call right away here. Manuel is calling from Boston. Hi, Manuel. You're on the air.
Hi, hello. I'm a photojournalist, and I cover the war in Iraq.
All right.
And I was in the middle of bad stuff, and that kind of fear it's a completely different kind of fear from the one you feel when you are in the midst of this beast that this guy is talking about.
Have you confronted beasts as a photojournalist? Or
actually, we just did a story about bear country, and we were in Glacier National Park, which you would say these bears are habituated to seeing people.
This is in Montana,
In Montana, yes. We actually went out into the Bob Marshall Wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could actually see wild grizzly bears. And we saw one of these guys maybe 1,500 feet away and with my big lenses and everything, and it was as scary gets. It's primal. It gets to the base of your spine, and you just don't even want to move. And you know you're safe because you're that far away, but still, it goes back to the basics, survival instincts.
It's deeply bred in the bone. Manuel, thanks very much for that story. David Quammen, in both of these, here we've got a shark and grizzly bear, but somehow it's almost instinctive, that deep imprint of fear of the greater beastly power.
Yeah, that's great that we heard both of those voices. And both of them are testifying to two things. They're testifying to how uncannily scary these creatures are when you see them in their power, their capacity to kill, their majesty. And I think both fellows were also telling us, well, clearly they were, that form of fear has a thrill to it, has a richness to it, has an edifying value to it that is just irreplaceable.
You looked at brown bears in the Carpathian Mountains in Romania. What did you find there?
Right. First I went there because I heard the astonishing fact that there are now more than 5,000 brown bear in the Carpathians of Romania.
And is a brown essentially a grizzly? Is it the same?
It is. This is Ursus arctos, same species as the grizzly. And this is the largest population of brown bear in Europe west of the Russian border. Now, most people, myself included, would have thought of Romania as some sort of an industrialized, possibly blighted Eastern Bloc, former communist
country.
Smokestacks
and all that.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And there is some of that in southern Romania around Bucharest. But there are also these beautiful mountains, the Carpathians, still covered with very good beech and oak forest and filled with brown bears, more than 5,000 brown bear. And so I started going to Romania to answer the question, well, how can there be? Why are there more than 5,000 brown bear in Romania? And it took me a number of trips before I could sort out the complicated sort of convergence of reasons why that's the case.
But they're there. Are they interacting with human populations? I mean, it's one thing to admire and applaud these animals from 1,500 meters or 1,500 miles away. It's another to live next door.
They are. They are sharing their habitat in the highlands, especially during the summer, with shepherds and sheep. There are a lot of Romanian shepherd camps on the high meadows during the summer. Men go up there, tend a flock of 300, 600, 1,000 sheep, live out of a little cabin, sleep among the sheep, and milk the sheep to make cheese.
And how do they regard the bears?
Well, I talked to a number of these shepherds. I did a long walking tour through the highlands, and I heard different things from different shepherds. There was a diversity of views. Some of them simply said, La Naiba Kuurshi, the hell with the bear. It'd be better for me if you killed them off, got rid of them all. Mm. And that's maybe what you'd expect from shepherds. But then there are other shepherds, some very calm, gentle, almost philosophical souls that I talked to who would tell me things like, well, the bear, certainly it makes my job harder and a little bit more dangerous. But the bear, as one man told me, the bear is Podwaba Padurii, the treasure of the forest. If you got rid of the bear, oh, it would be a pity. It would be a tragedy. He told me, a forest without bears, it's empty.
David's calling from New Bern, North Carolina. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I teach 10th grade English in North Carolina, and we deal with world literature.
Yeah.
I've had my experiences out in the woods. And as I hear this conversation about the alpha predators, mm-hmm. and I think about it in the context of world literature from Gilgamesh on down, the question and comment that I have is that as we move into the 21st century, while you all listed about 6 to 7 major predators, it seems as we move into the 21st century, some of our predators are microbiological, like SARS, AIDS, cancer, those things that truly frighten us.
Anthrax, Ebola. Anthrax. So what does that leave you thinking, David? Are these just as effective as symbols, as icons that might encourage human humility, or is it something else?
Certainly, because the author spoke of how the predators, and if you read Gilgamesh, the ancient Sumerian epic, mm-hmm. the lion figures in the symbolism. There is Humbaba, the monster they confront. And then when you read Job, you get into the issue of boils and sores, and yet his family is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
That as we move into the 21st century, how can we gain humility from these alpha predatory viruses? And the other fears that we move into. And I think that perhaps there's a parallel between the huge monsters and those monsters we confront every day. And I would like to hear what the author has to say about
that. It's a great question, David. Thanks so much for calling it in. David Quammen, how about it? There are other fearsome forms of life in the world.
There are, yeah. Thank you, David, for that. There are monstrous microbial threats to us. Then again, there always have been. Those sorts of threats have always been afflicting humans. They've always been killing us off. People have been, you know, in the 14th century, it was the bubonic plague. It's not new for us to be terrified of and facing emerging diseases. That's an ancient form of threat to us. And this other form of threat was always coming from something that was larger and more majestic, not smaller and mysterious. Both of those threats have always been there and have always reminded us that we're mortal, that we die.
David Quammen, hold the thought. We have to take a short break. We'll come back to the thread. We're talking about great beasts, monsters of God. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about lions, tigers, bears, the vanishing alpha predators, and the impact of their loss on the planet and on human psyche. My guest tonight is David Quammen. He joins us from St. Paul. He's author of the new book, Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. David Quammen, we ran into the break before perhaps we fully answered that last question. You were drawing a distinction and saying that there's a difference between these great majestic creatures that could take a human being on one-on-one and tear that human being to pieces, and microbiological threats of all kinds that have been so much in the news in the last couple of years. Take us further with that, because as we understand science better, as these micro-level creatures become more real, is it still never going to be their place to fulfill that kind of overwhelming, fearsome role that great creatures historically have filled?
No, I think it's not. And I think I can boil the difference down into one word or maybe two words, majesty or terrible majesty. There are lots of things that cause human death. Some of those are microbial. Some of them are wildlife. For instance, the malarial mosquito could be considered the most lethal form of wildlife on the planet. Millions of people a year die from malaria. But it's not the same as the alpha predators that I'm talking about. It doesn't have the terrible majesty, the sort of the ambivalent mixture of fear and admiration that we feel and have felt for these big, handsome, powerful creatures that could kill and eat us.
Hard to think of a handsome microbe. Chris is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great program. A thought came to me when that last caller was on about the micro predators, that there's a huge sociological impact difference between a micro and a macro predator. The macro predators, the alpha predators you've been discussing, tended to bring us together in groups. It forced us to form unions, to incorporate them into religions and whatnot.
To huddle around the campfire together.
Yeah, to be around the... the micro predators, the diseases, tend to force us apart, make us afraid to touch each other, to drink the same water, to breathe the same air, to be in the same room.
They make us enemies almost even to each other. It's a great point, Chris. Thanks for calling. David Quammen.
Yes, it is a great point. I hadn't thought about that, but he's absolutely right. Big predators tend to move humans toward sort of a defensive herd behavior. It possibly is even one of the things that led to us becoming socialized, developing languages, developing collective hunting skills. I wouldn't press that too far, but I think it's a great point.
And a lot of notes to compare. You said that the human beings first, one of the first points of awareness was awareness of being meat. That's something to talk about with the person next door and how to avoid becoming that. Mm-hmm. Tell us about a couple of the other animals you looked at most closely. There was the Siberian tiger. We hear about it. I don't have a real sense, though, before reading your book, of exactly its status.
Mm-hmm. The Siberian tiger, yeah, that was one of the... I wanted to look at cases that were a little bit obscure and yet important diagnostic, that were off the beaten path. So I looked at lions in India rather than tigers, and I looked at tigers in Russia, where they live in the mountains, the Sikhot Alin Mountains, a very wild stretch of landscape just north of the city of Vladivostok.
Way out in the far east along the... And are the great white tigers still there?
Well, actually, they're not white. That's a fallacy. People assume that Siberian tigers are white tigers. White tigers are a mutant form that comes from India and come from interbreeding, of incestuous interbreeding of white tigers. And generally, it's an artifact that's created in zoos for the entertainment of people.
Got it. So what do the Siberians look like?
Siberian tigers are a little bit more pale than a Bengal tiger, but they are essentially orange and chocolate brown. They have a little bit longer fur because they live in a very cold climate in the winter. They travel through the snow. They hunt deer and wild boar.
And are they protected in the far east of Russia today, or how do they survive? In what numbers?
They survive in these mountains in a population of about 300 animals, again, similar to the Asiatic lion at Gir. This is the largest single remaining population of Siberian tiger, also known as Amur tiger, because it's part of the Amur River drainage out there.
Are they hunted?
And they are poached occasionally. They are protected by the Russian government. The protection is good, but it's not perfect. So occasionally a tiger is killed and snuck out of the country and sold off for tiger parts, for traditional medicines.
But with only 300 some left, we can easily imagine that these could fall in your 150-year range. Gary's calling from Boscobel, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
I'm living here in southern Wisconsin. I see our open landscape being continually swallowed up by rural development, and it's put me into thinking about what the actual open space to the human species means, the idea of open space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's led me in a direction of wondering about not only these large predator species, but also somewhat smaller species, and what happens to the human species when we lose other species. And I'm wondering about the process of evolution and whether we are incapable of thinking far enough down into the future to think about where we want to go evolutionarily and what other species do to affect that direction.
It's a great question. Let us pick it straight up. And thanks for your call, Gary. How do you see that, David? You've given the whole issue a lot of thought here. If these animals, and we hate to imagine it, but you really describe it in concrete terms, 150 years, they could be gone. What does that mean for human beings? Do they stay in legend and lore? Do they become as distant as dinosaurs? How do humans evolve without them?
Well, I think there are two kinds of impact that we'll experience, and I think both of those will be more severe than we foresee. One is the biological impact of removing these big predators, which in many cases are keystone species, from their ecosystems, from their ecological communities. There will be repercussions. There will be losses, other losses within those ecosystems, because of ramifying ecological effects.
You read about a pestilence of minor nibblers cropping
right.
the vegetation down to stubs, interfering with tree reproduction, jeopardizing renewal of the forest canopy. In other words, the creatures they might have eaten.
Right.
Running,
right. You take away the big predators, and the medium-sized predators or their prey animals become more abundant when they're not being preyed on, and then that level of creature then has impact on the ecosystem.
And right on it goes. And what about on human evolution? We've just got a couple of minutes here. Give us the core of what you fear when and if these go.
Well, I find it almost impossible to talk about future human evolution in biological terms because the cultural, the technological evolution that we're going through is swamping out the biological evolution now. But the psychological impact and spiritual impact of losing these creatures, I think, will be very severe. To put it very simply, we'll be discovering that the planet that we live on is uglier, more boring, and more lonely than the planet that we inherited from our ancestors.
And that
there'll be a cosmic loneliness that we feel as these predators disappear, and we realize that there's nothing bigger than us, there's nothing more majestic in us than us on this planet and possibly in the entire universe.
And unlike microbes, these are creatures we can look at and in some strange way identify with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
When they stand up tall on those big legs. David Quammen, it's an incredible tour that you've provided in the book, and we really thank you for going out and paying attention to what's going out, to what's going on this front. We hope your 150-year horizon is wrong, but you say you're a pessimist. That's the way you see it.
I hope I'm wrong too, Tom. I prefer not to be looking at this sort of a future, but if you do the arithmetic, including the projected continuing human population growth and growth in human levels of consumption, then you just cannot avoid the expectation that the wild landscape will be gone and these creatures will be gone with it.
Listeners, pay attention. Let's see what we can do. David Quammen, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to talk with you, Tom.
David Quammen is author of Monster of God, The Man-Eating Predator in the Jungles of History and the Mind. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Confessions of the Mother of a Music Downloader. This is On Point. The Recording Industry Association of America is changing its strategy for going after illegal music downloaders. RIAA Chairman Mitch Bainwall told a Senate panel this week that the music industry will begin to notify illegal file sharers before they're sued, giving them a chance to settle or dispute the accusations. Earlier this month, the RIAA sued more than 250 Internet users for music piracy. To date, 52 of the suits have reportedly been settled for between $2,500 and $10,000 each. Maryland resident Susan Reimer had no idea that her daughter was breaking the law by downloading music on the family computer until the recent wave of lawsuits. In this radio diary, she says file sharing has become just one more thing she has to worry about as the mother of a teenage daughter.
It's a fact of life in the MTV age that our kids go through their busy days with a soundtrack playing in the background. And these are not just tunes in their heads. There is music to get them going in the morning before school, music for warming up before a game, dance music, music for cruising, music for doing homework. It seems as if it is music, not food or sleep, that powers them through their overscheduled days. Talk about mood music. My daughter has CDs she's marked mad and sad. There is one marked rejects, too, and I can only hope that it describes the songs. The problem is, many of our kids have come by this music illegally. While we were loading the dishwasher after dinner, they were downloading hundreds of songs onto the family computer and then burning just the right mix onto a CD. And all of these tunes are pirated, stolen from artists whose CDs the kids are not buying. Until the record industry started suing us, I didn't even realize downloading was a problem. Most of us were vaguely aware of the banning of the music-sharing site Napster, but when Kazaa took its place, I assumed that the recording industry and the computer industry had come up with some kind of compromise. Forgive me if I was busy worrying about what our children were doing in cars at night instead of what they were doing on the computer in the family room. Besides, everybody was downloading. Kazaa had 7 million members last May when my daughter found it and started downloading like mad. According to estimates, 60 million Americans are downloading, including my very respectable neighbor, who put together a compilation CD to play in his new car with his first-ever CD player. How was he different from me at 20-something, making cassette tapes of my favorite songs off my FM stereo tuner just before beginning a 6-month van trip around the country? And it's not like the kids were downloading behind our backs and then lying about it. My daughter's best friend burned a special CD for me for my birthday, for heaven's sake. Suddenly, we parents woke up to find that the recording industry was not happy. It had been losing CD sales, and now it is suing for up to $150,000 a download to stop the erosion. Now, along with safe sex, underage drinking, illegal drug use, the evils of smoking, and the value of education, I and my fellow parents have to talk to our children about the intricacies of copyright law. We can tell them downloading is the same as shoplifting a CD or plagiarizing a term paper, but it is hard to convince kids that came of age with downloading that they have been doing something wrong. And especially when the kids believe that the odds of their getting caught are mathematically insignificant. Not so parents, who live with the terrible certainty that any random calamity is waiting to strike their child. So I immediately stripped Kazaa and all the telltale music tracks off our home computer and told my 17-year-old daughter that she'd have to start using her allowance to buy tracks off the various for-sale sites that are popping up on the web. I am not taking on the recording industry, I told her. My life is over, was Jessie's response. And I could only wonder what tracks this child, who seemed to have a mixed CD to fit every new swing in her mood, would choose to score this unhappy development.
Susan Reimer is a columnist with the Baltimore Sun. She lives in Annapolis, Maryland. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jupp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook and John Parati. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.